It's hard to imagine. If you haven't had a recent loss, if you haven't had hard times recently in your life, and maybe you've been on your feet for a while and all is well, it's hard to imagine going into the holidays without looking forward to it. You don't look forward to the credit card bills, but if you've got a good job, you say, all right, we weathered it last year, we'll weather it this year. The family's all around, everyone is healthy, and it seems like a time. How could anyone be unhappy at a time like this? And yet we know that the time of Christmas and the other holidays that are being celebrated this time of year is often a time in which people who have suffered loss or tragedy or hardship or in the midst of that find these days very difficult. How do we offer them hope? How do we comfort them during this time? We're going to talk about that for just a few minutes here at the beginning of this hour with Pastor Henry Gehrke, director of the Concordia Seminary Chorus. He also serves as cantor at Reformation Lutheran Church in Afton. And Reformation Lutheran will be having a service of hope and comfort at the time of Advent and Christmas this Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. We'll talk a little bit about that in just a minute. Henry, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you.
What is it about these times, these days around the holidays, to speak generally about them, that makes it so difficult on people who have suffered losses of loved ones or jobs or you name it?
We oftentimes hear this Christmas song called It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year. And for many people it is, without any doubt. But there are, for a lot of Christians, a lot of people who have suffered the loss of a loved one through death or because of the loss of health due to illness or injury or perhaps the loss of employment or maybe the loss of a marriage through divorce or through separation, that this can be also the most difficult time of the year. It's difficult enough trying to go on with life, let alone trying to celebrate the Christmas holiday when your heart aches because of the empty chair at the table or because the long familiar voice is still or because your own body is revolting against you because of disease or injury or because depression is too much to bear or because loneliness surrounds you even in a crowd.
So we're talking about people who are sitting in the pews of our churches on a regular basis throughout the year who may not have family nearby who will be with them, who have lost a loved one, or maybe it was years ago, and they're still feeling the loss of
right.
a husband or a wife.
Right.
We're talking about real-life Christians.
Right. And it can be people who, for some reason or other, are not always able to get to church as frequently as they would like to, that they oftentimes suffer these at this time. And Christmas, especially, the way our society has emphasized it, becomes such a family-oriented, a very strong emotional time for people. And it's almost just expected that you're going to be up, always on the upside of things all the time. But here, the reality is that oftentimes it's very difficult to be up all the time, but to be that happy and that even trying to sing Silent Night may be a very difficult time because of all the emotions and memories that come back.
Does the church, especially a church that is now drunk so deeply of pop culture, does the church also impose unrealistic expectations on the faithful at a year like this, almost an enforced happiness? You know, it's Christmas, so. Darn it. Why aren't you happy like the rest of us?
Right. I think that the church falls into the same trap as so much of our society does. We all come across with a mall type of mentality towards the holidays, that everything's going to be holly jolly Christmas, and sometimes it isn't for people.
You wanted to talk a little bit here in the few minutes we have left, Henry, about the word comfort. Why is that word especially operative at a time like this and in an effort to reach out to Christians who are in pain?
Yeah, the word comfort goes back to a Latin word in its roots, meaning with strength. And oftentimes the fact that, unfortunately today, when we think of comfort, we're thinking of a Lazy Boy or a Barker Lounger type of chair that everything's nice and comfortable, cozy and warm and that. But with comfort, what makes Christmas sometimes very difficult for people is because they do not feel they have the strength, that they do not have the comfort, or another way of putting it, maybe the backbone to go through it. And that's why in our service that we're focusing on is not ourselves, but on God and on His Word, what He has done for us, and the comfort that He gives us.
So tell us a little bit about the service at Reformation that's going to be this Sunday at 4 p.m., this service of comfort and hope in the midst of these times. Tell us about how you apply God's Word, both through preaching but also through song and through the liturgy, to people who are feeling these times especially keenly.
Well, some of the hymns that will be sung address that along with all of the other hopes and fears that we have. We begin with O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. And that talks a lot about, you know, people being in exile, loneliness, under sorrow. And the hymn itself gives us a lot of comfort because it directs us to the God who answers those questions. Come along, expected Jesus. We talk about how God is in Jesus Christ, is born to save us, born to set us free from our sins. And then we have another Silent Night, and then also a hymn that I really consider more of a Advent hymn, but it is most often sung at Christmas time, and that is O Little Town of Bethlehem, that in all the hopes and fears are met in thee tonight. Those are the hymns. The part of God's Word that we hear will be from Psalm 25, where we will pray that responsively, that it talks about that I lift up my soul to you, O Lord. I trust in you, my God. I put my hope in you. And that's a reoccurring theme of that psalm. No matter what happens, that our hope is in God. And then we hear from Isaiah chapter 40, the great comfort chapter, where he says, comfort, comfort these my people. Let them know that their sins are forgiven and their warfare is over with. And that those who are weak will have their strength renewed like the eagles. And then what puts this all into context and shows us where our hope is Matthew chapter 1, where Matthew goes through the story of the account of Jesus' birth and that he is come to save his people from their sins.
Henry, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc. Thank you for that. And looking forward to the service of hope and comfort at the time of Advent and Christmas that's going to be held at Reformation Lutheran Church this Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. And Reformation Lutheran Church is located on Hege Road, if I'm not mistaken.
Just north of Hege Road on Mackenzie Road, right. Mackenzie Road in Afton.
It's at 7910 Mackenzie Road, Reformation Lutheran Church. The public, by the way, is invited.
And the phone number is area code 314-352-1355.
Thank you very much, Henry.
Thank you.
That phone number again, 314-352-1355. The service is at 4 p.m. this coming Sunday afternoon. You know, Jesus did not come into the world taking on human flesh just to make our happy lives a little, just that little bit more happy. That's the way he is often presented, as kind of the cherry on top of what is the banana split of our life. No, he came to give us an entirely new life. He came into real people, and he continues to come to real people, real Christians who live real lives, not the sugar-coated lives that are often presented by today's therapeutic church, not people who live under enforced happiness, but people who, like people of the Old Testament and the New, mourn in lonely exile here. He comes to bring abiding joy, genuine peace and hope and genuine comfort. We're going to spend the remainder of this half of this hour talking with Phyllis Schlafly of Eagle Forum. She's author of a book called Feminist Fantasies. She's been with us before to talk about this, but she got honorable mention in a column today that appeared in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Nationally syndicated columnist Ellen Goodman wrote about the Equal Rights Amendment, and perhaps, she says, it ought to be discussed again. And she mentions Phyllis Schlafly, her opposition during in the 70s to the Equal Rights Amendment. Phyllis will join us here in just a moment, just so that all of us understand that service of hope and comfort at the time of Advent and Christmas is this Sunday afternoon at 4 at Reformation Lutheran Church on Mackenzie Road. It's 7910 Mackenzie Road in Afton, and we'll be reminding you about that a little bit later in the week as well. Phyllis Schlafly is our guest. Ellen Goodman wrote about this and the Equal Rights Amendment. Is it true that the Equal Rights Amendment has, the fact that it hasn't been passed, has left women with something less than equal rights? Phyllis, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Yes, very happy to join you. The Equal Rights Amendment died on June 30th, 1982. It was given originally a life of 7 years, and then Congress gave it a 3-year extension. So it died on June 30th, 1982, and it has no legal vitality at the present time.
Ellen Goodman says that women suffer because it wasn't passed. She says they have only the side effects of equality, not genuine equality. How do you evaluate that?
Well, they do have a lot of bad effects that the feminists have given us. Certainly they were big promoters of divorce, and they were big promoters of putting women in combat and combat-related jobs, so the ones who were injured or killed or taken prisoner over in Iraq can thank the feminists for their injuries. So there have been some bad effects of what the feminists have been doing, but they're not effects of the Equal Rights Amendment because we don't have that. Now, in 10 years of debating it, they were never able to show any benefit that women would get out of ERA.
She kind of characterizes, Ellen Goodman does, the opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment as basically warnings about unisex toilets, women in combat, and gay marriage. Was that really the essence of your opposition and the opposition of so many to the Equal Rights Amendment?
Well, women in combat was a big issue. Well, and I think you see the results of that with Jessica and Shoshana and Laurie, who was killed. And that was a big issue, especially if women were drafted, which the draft was in effect when ERA was being debated. Same-sex marriage is pretty obvious. That's what they want. I mean, we're in a whole national campaign to get same-sex marriages, and ERA would give it to them if ERA were in the Constitution, because ERA says you can't discriminate on account of sex.
Well, and Goodman's argument seems to be something like this. Look, we have women in combat now. We have unisex toilets. We have gay marriage, or at least we're on the verge of having gay marriage. All we need now is the Equal Rights Amendment or something like it.
We don't have gay marriage. We don't have same-sex marriage. They're trying to do this in Massachusetts, and I don't think they're going to get by with it. But we're certainly not going to have it in the other 49 states. The federal law says that marriage is a man and a woman as husband and wife. And there's no indication that the American people are going to acquiesce in this demand by the gays and the feminists to give us same-sex marriage. But if we had an Equal Rights Amendment, it would be constitutionally mandated. And I can't think of a better reason to be opposed to ERA. American people do not want to give marriage license to same-sex couples.
So you're saying that the Equal Rights Amendment would further the cause of the homosexual agenda with regard to gay marriage?
There's no question about it. If you look at the text of it, the Equal Rights Amendment says equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Now, if you deny marriage license to a man and a man, you've obviously discriminated on account of sex. And the majority of the American people do not want to do this, and we don't have ERA, And you've got to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to realize the demands of the gay movement at the present time. They're carrying around all over the place. Are we going to let them get by with it? If they had ERA, they would have it. And fortunately, we don't have ERA, so we're able to tell them to get lost.
Phyllis, why do feminists keep bringing this back around for discussion? It seems about once a year there's someone who says, oh, for the days when we carried those ERA signs, and oh, for the days when we had that kind of unity and we were in the streets marching for this stuff, and oh, for the days when that was our goal.
Well, most of them don't have any children, and they don't have anything else to do. They like to prance around and tell women they're victims and they're oppressed, and agitate for their goals. And certainly the gay rights agenda is one of their principal goals. Another principal goal is women in combat. And you can see with the experience of these three women, Jessica Lynch, who said if she'd known what was going to happen, she never would have signed up. Shoshana, who was a POW, and Laurie, the one from Arizona, who was killed, they didn't want to be there. Shoshana wanted to be an Army cook. And they were sent over there because of the feminists in the Clinton administration put them in areas where they had a risk of capture. I think that's an embarrassment to our country. I think that's done by the kind of a man who, when he hears a noise at 2 a.m., would send his wife down to investigate the noise. I think this is an embarrassment to our country, and it is pushed by the feminists like Ellen Goodman, and it is an absolute disgrace to our country, and they think that's great. They think when they look at Laurie being killed and how Jessica Lynch was treated and how Shoshana was treated, they think that's a great advancement for women. They call that breaking through the glass ceiling and showing women can do anything men can do. And I say I certainly think less of the men who sent them out there. That war is no place for a woman.
We're talking
but the ERA would mandate it.
We're talking with Phyllis Schlafly, president of Eagle Forum, author of the book Feminist Fantasies. I'll tell you about that in just a moment. Another thing that Ellen Goodman laments is the fact that the U.S. has not signed the U.N. Treaty on Women's Rights. Why hasn't the U.S. signed that treaty?
Well, certainly we don't want a foreign commission monitoring our relationship of men and women. That's what it would mean. The United Nations Treaty on Women would set up a monitoring committee. And it would be much broader even than the Equal Rights Amendment because it would govern private relationships. It even would allow them to monitor our textbooks and change our textbooks to comport with the feminist ideology. The lot of women around the rest of the world is so far behind what we have in the United States, there's no comparison. We don't want the way women are treated in other countries is just dreadful compared with American women. And we don't want foreigners monitoring what we do in this country.
I've heard someone say that the Equal Rights Amendment was not so much about, it was not properly named, it wasn't so much about equal rights as it was about erasing all distinctions, both good and both bad and good, between men and women. Would you concur?
The Equal Rights Amendment would have made every law gender neutral. Now, in some areas we like that, but our employment laws were already gender neutral. But we certainly don't want our military laws, we certainly don't want our marriage laws gender neutral. We want to recognize that there is a husband and a wife, and there's a mother and a father.
The feminist would argue, but Phyllis, we need something more because even though we have gender-neutral laws with regard to employment, there's still a gap between what men are paid and what women are paid.
That's because women don't do the same jobs men do. If they do the same jobs for the same number of hours a week, they get the same pay. But most women do not do the same jobs. Men take the risky, dangerous jobs in this country. 95% of the job-related injuries are men. Is that because they're clumsy? No, it isn't. It's because the men are willing to take a lot of the jobs that the women are not willing to take. And they're entitled to be paid for those jobs.
Another agenda for the feminist when it comes to the workplace is daycare at work provided by the employer or by the government. How do you respond to that plea?
Well, your boss is not responsible to take care of your baby. The mother and father are responsible to take care of the baby. You see, the feminists think it's oppression of women that we expect mothers to take care of their babies. That's their attitude. They think the government or the employer should take care of the babies. I don't think so. I think mothers and fathers should take care of them. It's not the job of the boss or the government or the taxpayers to take care of babies.
Finally, Phyllis, what's the future of feminism? Is Ellen Goodman and those like her who are calling for the remembering the ERA, are they dinosaurs?
Well, they are, and of course most of them don't have any children, so one of these days they're going to die out. But those of us who have children understand from the cradle that there is a major difference between men and women, between boys and girls, and we're entitled to reflect those differences. Now, the feminists do have some people in powerful places. They have Hillary Clinton in the Senate, and they have Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. So they're still able to create a whole lot of mischief. But their attitude toward life is destructive. Their goals are destructive. And they include attacks on marriage, attacks on motherhood. They always promote the entire gay agenda. And they want the feminization of the military. So I would suggest that people get a copy of my new book, Feminist Fantasies, which will tell you what they're really all about. You can get a good half-price deal by calling the publisher direct, which is 1-888-773-6782. That's 1-888-773-6782.
Phyllis Schlafly, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Always good to join you.
Folks, you can purchase Phyllis Schlafly's latest book, Feminist Fantasies. The number for Spence Publishing, 1-888-SPENPUB, SPENPUB, 1-888-SPENPUB, or go online to the website for Spence Publishing, www.spencepublishing.com. Now, when we come back from this break, Hanukkah started a couple days ago, didn't it? What is Hanukkah? I had someone ask me that recently. I can't remember who it was. They said, what is Hanukkah? Is that a religious holiday? I said, well, kind of and kind of not. Does it have anything to do with Christmas? Well, no. Why does it always fall around the time of Christmas? What are Jews celebrating with the Festival of Lights and Hanukkah? We'll be talking with Pastor Ed Balfour, a former Orthodox Jew and pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Cape Elizabeth, Maine, about the Jewish festival Hanukkah. I got a question. This is, you know, when we get around Easter and Passover, the church celebrates Easter, the Jews are celebrating Passover, and a lot of Christians, too, go do their Seder suppers. And they're kind of mock Passover dinners. You've heard me talk about this before, I always do. Christians playing Jewish. You don't see him doing this so much during Hanukkah. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you think Christian parents should avoid the subject of Santa Claus with their children? Did you know that the real Saint Nicholas was a 4th century pastor? But did he really live at the North Pole and distribute gifts on Christmas Eve? How do we separate fact from fiction? Issues Etc. and Concordia Publishing House recommend the new children's book, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. The book costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org. And under the What's New section, you'll find information on St. Nicholas by Julie Stiegemeyer. The book contains museum-quality artwork with family-friendly language. Issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040. St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Planned Parenthood is making a killing in the abortion business, according to figures just released by the abortion provider. In 2003, the organization recorded a $36 million profit, three times what they made last year. Steve Jordahl reports.
Planned Parenthood is bucking the trend.
Across the United States, the abortion rates are still falling, and yet at Planned Parenthood, it went up from 213,000 last year to 227,385 this year.
Stop Planned Parenthood Executive Director Jim Sedlak says almost a third of the abortion provider's clinic income is from abortions. In fact, he says the income is so important they often close clinics that don't turn a profit.
If Planned Parenthood services are so important to the community, why don't they just use a little bit of their profit and keep them open?
Randall O'Bannon of the National Right to Life Committee says the reason this was a banner year for Planned Parenthood is partly because the President and Congress have been vocal in support of life.
They've tried to take the opportunity where that there has been a pro-life president in the White House, and they have really used it to capitalize and energize their donor base.
Those donors might think they're giving to an organization dedicated to family planning. O'Bannon says they would be wrong.
Planned Parenthood's plans typically don't include parenthood. They're not prepared for it. They talk about being for choice, but they really don't offer women much of a choice when they go into a Planned Parenthood clinic.
Planned Parenthood refused to comment for this story. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
While Planned Parenthood says they performed almost a quarter of a million abortions in 2002, they referred less than 2,000 women to adoption agencies. U.S. taxpayers gave more than $250 million to the nonprofit organization, roughly a third of its total income. O'Bannon expects to see a similar report next year. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On Thursday's Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. It's an Ask the Expert with Dr. Stephanie Van Olft from Heartland Human Services in Effingham, Illinois. She is at your service the entire hour if you want to talk about the ups and downs of the Christmas season, any emotional questions you have. She is at your service, and Joni Harwell and I will be hosting. It's Thursday on Living Jubilee.
Issues Etc. and Concordia Publishing House are excited about our book of the month for December, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. It's the perfect Christmas gift for your young child or grandchild. St. Nicholas is published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this new children's book at issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking in this half hour with Pastor Ed Balfour, a former Orthodox Jew and pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Cape Elizabeth, Maine, about the festival being celebrated by Jews, secular Jews, Orthodox Jews, Jews of every stripe, during this time of the year, started a couple days ago, Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights. We're going to find out what it is. What is it a celebration of, and does it have anything to do with Christmas, although it seems always to be associated at the for the time of Christmas? Pastor Ed Balfour is our guest. Feel free to join us with questions or comments at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Pastor Ed Balfour, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. How come you never call me at Advent? You only call me on the Jewish holidays. That really bothers me. Can I interview you tonight?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I have a question for you. Really, it's about Hanukkah. I think maybe you can help me out. Really. I mean, you know, I was baptized when I was 20, and back in those days, I noticed that right after Thanksgiving, they started to put up the Christmas decorations. Now, when I went shopping in October, there's Halloween, there's Christmas, there's seems to me there's Easter decorations up. My question is, you know, we don't make that big a deal about Hanukkah. How come it takes you people so long to shop? This is my problem.
Well,
Can you answer that, please?
Question.
Don't avoid the question.
We have a hard time making up our minds.
I see.
So we've got stereotypes running both ways here this evening, don't we?
Yes.
All right.
No problem having a friend in Jesus on Christmas Eve, though, believe me.
Well, that's true. Tell me about what you remember. You were an Orthodox Jew up to the point of your 20th year. What do you remember about Hanukkah from your childhood?
Well, Hanukkah was really kind of a kiddie holiday. You have to remember that the Festival of Lights, the story comes out of the Book of Maccabees. About 165 B.C., there's the rededication of the temple that Antiochus IV had taken over in Palestine, had profaned the temple. And on a date somewhere around December 25th, in conjunction with the Gregorian calendar, the temple is now dedicated, and so rededicated. And the fable goes that there, when the dedication took place, you know, there's the above the altar, the eternal light, that there was only enough oil to burn for a day. And the Maccabees had to ride through the enemies and get oil for the lamp. They didn't come back for 8 days, and the lamp burned for 8 days once the temple was rededicated. So in this holiday, on eight successive nights, the children would receive gifts, and not big gifts, Hanukkah gelt, meaning money, or chocolate Hanukkah gelt, which is you can find in the stores, in the Christmas tree stores today. You look at it, it's Israeli chocolate, which is very fine chocolate, but we were kind of envious of Christmas, of our Christian counterparts. I mean, we got a crummy little menorah, and you guys got a big tree in Times Square.
Now, what strikes me is that at Jewish holidays, and you're going to be able to answer this far better than any kind of speculation I could come up with, but it strikes me that at Jewish holidays, even the most secular of Jews kind of gets Jewish, at least for the 8 days of Hanukkah or for maybe around the Seder. He gets Jewish for those days. He may not believe anything attached to it, but for him it's a matter of, well, this is part of what it is to be who I
Jewish.
Am.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I have a couple that comes to my church. A lady comes from the Wisconsin Synod, and this gentleman has been in this town where there's not that many Jews, has been the pseudo-rabbi over at what was the Orthodox synagogue in town for many years. And he bemoans the fact that even the people in the Orthodox synagogue are basically nothing but secular traditional Jews. I mean, Judaism is as much tradition as it is belief. I mean, my wife and I were discussing this evening about, well, this is in the Bible, though. You know, the Book of Maccabees, like I said, is not really in the Bible. It's one of the scrolls. The Jews only believe in the first five books as canonical books, and everything else comes, this holiday comes out of the Talmud, out of the oral tradition. This is where they get most of the facts about the Maccabees. And my wife says, well, do they ever get to read the source? And I said, well, they consider the Talmud to be the source. They're not looking for what's in the Bible. And so basically, as you said, they become Jewish because most things are based on tradition and myth. And that's what it means to be Jewish today. And I think even growing up, that's what it meant to be Jewish when I was growing up. It's interesting. I always tell people I learned more about the Bible, the Old Testament Bible, since I've been a Christian, that I did going to Hebrew school from the time I was in kindergarten to my bar mitzvah, which was 8 years.
So is it safe to say that Judaism, both ancient and modern, but especially modern in the Western world, is as much a product of the Talmud, that is the writings of the rabbis in the intertestamental period and a little bit before, than it is the product of the Old Testament?
Absolutely. If you were to ask an Orthodox Jew what holds authority, it would certainly be the Talmud. On Saturdays, the rabbi, I studied with the rabbi because he picked one student out of the Hebrew school to study with on the Sabbath, and I was that student, but we certainly didn't study the Bible. We studied Talmud. And that's what you would study.
What did you find there in the Talmud? What was the essence of the teaching?
Well, the essence of the teaching that is so different from Christianity is when you're looking at salvation, you're looking at man earning his salvation. Vicarious atonement is only through animals. And so, you know, in fact, I have a book that was presented to me by the rabbi when I made my bar mitzvah, and it says in there, I always remember this quote, it says that when a man dies, he only has his good works to take with him. On Judgment Day, according to Judaism, when you come before the Lord, it won't be your faith that's judged. It'll be your works that's judged. Your works count. And so that's the main difference. I mean, I always remember, you know, the Inquirer's class in Lutheranism, by grace you're saved through faith. This was quite a revelation to me.
So is there anything distinctively biblical, from a Christian perspective, about the holiday of Hanukkah?
No. No, I mean, there's again, it's in the apocryphal writings. It's certainly not in the scriptures. It's not in the Old Testament. It would be a separate scroll. And to the Jews, though, it would hold as much sway, though, for them as the Book of Esther, where for us the Book of Esther certainly is there, you know. So, you know, and again, it depends how much authority that the Talmud's going to give it.
There's a write-up in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch this last weekend with the beginning of Hanukkah in the religion section, and it is eloquent about the hope of Hanukkah, the deeper meaning of Hanukkah, the spirit of Hanukkah. What does all of this mean?
I mean, well, when I was raised as an Orthodox Jew, it would not be very important to me growing up. Those kind of sentiments just didn't exist in our house. I mean, Hanukkah was a children's holiday, wasn't celebrated except for a party at synagogue, but it was celebrated by families at home. And it, in some ways, it was the, you know, it kind of, it was something for the children to take their minds off of Christmas, because it usually fell around Christmas because of where, you know, where it originally was established.
You mentioned a bit of envy of the rest of us who were celebrating Christmas there.
Sure.
What was that like for a kid to watch basically Christmas on all of its pageantry on display for, well, in those days it wouldn't have been from Halloween until Christmas, but maybe from Thanksgiving until Christmas?
Well, number one, you felt left out. Number two, even in public school, I went to public school, the assembly in the morning, you sang Christmas carols. And I still remember, I always thought, what an odd Christmas carol, Away with the Major. That's how I heard it as a kid, you know, and I came home and asked my parents who the Major was that they were away with at Christmas. But you didn't watch a lot of TV during that time. And you could watch Rudolph and Santa Claus is Coming to Town, but your parents really steered you away. At that time, you had Hallmark stories on you know, Amal and the Night Visitors and all these. I still remember the names, and I've watched them since I've been an adult, but we were really, the TV went off. And you didn't go downtown at that time because there were all the Christmas decorations, and at that time Christmas decorations meant nativity scenes, especially in a very Roman Catholic New Orleans where I grew up.
Did you have a sense of what the Christians were genuinely selling? I mean, beyond the merchandising and the marketing and the commercialization of Christmas, did you have a sense of what the real festival of Christmas was for Christians?
Well, we knew it was about Jesus, and we certainly thought, how could anybody believe that this was the Messiah? We had that knowledge of that's what Christmas was about. Again, we grew up in a very Roman Catholic city. This was all over. It was on TV. It was on billboards and posters. It was at school. And so, yeah, we had a good sense of what Christians were worshiping, and as a Jewish community, we were very small and very isolated and very segregated anyhow. Even in school, in public school, we were segregated in classrooms. So, yeah, we had a good idea of what it was about, but we certainly felt left out. Now, the more what I would call Reformed Jews, including my aunt, had Hanukkah bushes, and the rest of the family didn't talk to them, but that was the way they coped with it.
What was that about? A Hanukkah bush was akin to a Christmas tree?
Yeah, except they called it a Hanukkah bush. We called my Aunt Millie Thoroughly Modern Millie, but, you know, was not something the rest of the family looked favorably upon. Jews did these things to mimic Christians at that time and probably to take some of the pressure off from their children who were talking about Christmas and what the Christian children received for gifts. I mean, the Hanukkah gifts certainly never rivaled the Christmas gifts.
We're talking with Pastor Ed Balfour, a former Orthodox Jew and pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Cape Elizabeth, Maine, about the Jewish festival of Hanukkah. One thing that I've noticed, you know, year after year, right around the time of Easter, when, again, there falls in coincidence another Jewish holiday, that being the Passover,
right.
Christians, it's all the rage nowadays for Christians to do their seders and to do their kind of mock Passover meals, and to get kind of Jewish during that time, but not so much around Hanukkah.
There's just not enough trappings for Hanukkah. I mean, you have the Christian children, whether we like it or not, you know, they focus in on Santa Claus and gift giving, and the Jews have the Hanukkah fairy. Now, you know, it doesn't quite compare.
The Hanukkah fairy?
The Hanukkah fairy, yes. We have the Hanukkah fairy. You know, it's sort of like the tooth fairy, except she's Jewish. So,
is she the one who's leaving the gifts on the eight successive nights?
That's the little children believe, yes. Well, you can see how this has no connection to anything scriptural.
When you were growing up, was there Hanukkah and all Jewish festivals now are all kind of being read through the lens of the Holocaust?
Right.
Was that part of the message of Hanukkah when you were growing up?
No, but you know, we kind of lived with the Holocaust. I mean, I had the cantor at my synagogue and his wife still had the numbers, the tattoos. They were in a concentration camp, and he met her there. He was forced to watch his first wife being tortured to death. They had pieces of fingers missing. We kind of lived. We weren't that far removed from the Holocaust, so we kind of lived with people who had been in the concentration camps. It wasn't very fashionable at that time for Christians to talk about the Holocaust, and the Jews were involved with it and spoke among themselves about it. And certainly at any given Friday night, there would be a gathering at my grandmother's house of various survivors of concentration camps, and Friday night's kind of service at the house. There were people from Poland and Russia and Romania, none of them speaking each other's language, but they all spoke Yiddish, which they learned in the concentration camp, and they conversed with one another that way and prayed that way.
So when you're driving down the street and you go through the town square, perhaps, I live in a little town, go through the town square, and what you'll see there is the obligatory creche. There'll be the nativity scene. There'll be a Santa, snowman, a couple reindeer, some Christmas trees, and a menorah.
Right.
There'll be one there just so that everyone gets covered.
Right.
Is that symbol, if Hanukkah is not a distinctively religious holiday, we're really talking about kind of the recognition of just another cultural holiday rather than the explicit religious symbolism of the manger scene, aren't we?
Yeah, but again, you're kind of missing the Jewish mindset. The Jewish mindset is that you can't separate culture from religion. That menorah, that seven-branched menorah that has an extra candle on it to light the others, it's a non-quote religious candle, non-holy candle, came about the same time as the seven-candle menorah, which, you know, is not used for Hanukkah, and that is in every synagogue. It is a symbol of Judaism. For me, growing up, you know, I saw a menorah that certainly was a religious item. In other words, every Jewish holy day, including Hanukkah, or as we say, it's Hanukkah, is a Sabbath. Some higher Sabbaths than other, like Yom Kippur would be the Day of Atonement, would be the highest Sabbath that there is. But, for instance, when you light the Hanukkah candles with the non-holy candle, the Shamus, the one that sits up top, it's the only one you can move. And just like the Sabbath candles on any given Friday night, once those candles are lit, they're holy candles, they're not to be moved until they burn out. So if you're trying to separate the two, you're making a mistake. So if when a Jew sees a menorah on a lawn, he sees a religious article.
So that says as much about Judaism as a religion / set of traditions, culture.
Yeah. I always say, you know, when we talk about missions in the Missouri Synod, it's good to see, you know, through the eyes of the culture you're trying to evangelize to. In other words, you know, when we try to evangelize to Jews by trying to dress up as Jews and have messianic temples and whatever, believe me, that doesn't work. In fact, it's offensive.
So this explains why oftentimes when someone who is of a more liberal Jewish persuasion is called on the carpet for not being Jewish enough by either their fellow Jews or by someone outside of Judaism, they might just return it with a blank stare saying, "What do you mean I'm not Jewish enough? I'm a Jew."
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, the Holocaust, as you talk about the Holocaust did more to bring Jews together as one than any other event. Not, you know, before the Holocaust, you had all these real separations. But when Hitler went after the Jews, he didn't care whether they were Reformed, Conservative, or Orthodox. It didn't make any difference to him. So when the Jews were all put in concentration camps, certainly they worshiped together. They realized they were Jews, that they had a common bond. They came up with a common language. And so the Holocaust, if there's anything that came out of that benefited, if you want to say, it benefited bringing people together who realized they were one people.
Two last questions here, Ed. How does Hanukkah pale by comparison to the birth of Christ and what Christians celebrate in the incarnation of our Savior?
Well, you know, you're asking me about something that was a kiddie holiday in comparison to something I believe and base my belief and faith of salvation in, you know, Christ's vicarious atonement on the cross that died so that mankind might be saved. You know, belief in the Messiah. There's not a, you know, this is not a messianic, if you will, holiday. It's a very minor holiday. It doesn't have anything to do with the Savior being born to die. There's no comparison.
Is it safe to say that part and parcel of the very definition of Judaism, insofar as it is a religious system and not just a set of cultural traditions, is a rejection, explicit rejection of Jesus Christ as the Messiah?
Absolutely. In fact, that's why Orthodox Jews refrain from saying Jesus Christ, because of what the word means. In fact, go so far as, and again, I remember very, very definitely how many years after kind of leaving the Jewish faith and just sitting in a church, I wouldn't say Jesus. I rejected saying the name. It took a lot of years before I was even able to mention Jesus as Christ. So yeah, it certainly is a rejection, in as much as, you know, at best a prophet, at worst a rabbi gone mad, is what a lot of Jews believe.
But certainly not the Messiah, and certainly not what Christians believed him to be.
Absolutely, positively not.
So then, as a former Orthodox Jew, with that said, there's been a lot of discussion in the church lately as to whether or not Jews and Christians worship the same God. How do you answer that question, Ed?
I would tell you, looking back and looking through filters of old, that when I looked at Christians, my belief was that Christians worship three gods and that they bow to graven images and considered that, you know, again, we had a lot of respect for devout Christians, but we believed that this was a religion of foolishness made up, that St. Paul, Saul, absolutely wrote as a kind of a joke on the world. So, you know, was not something that we would even have considered to be a valid religion, let alone worshiping the same God or even part of it.
So then now as a Christian, in answer to the same question, looking back upon this, how do you answer the question, do Jews and Christians worship the same God?
The answer is they do not. They most definitely do not. Did you know, if you're going to ask me, as some other people did the prophets of old, were they saved? I say, yeah, they were looking toward a Messiah. There's quite a difference, you know. But if you're asking me about Jews today, do they worship the same God or do they worship God? The answer, you have to say honestly, the answer is no. The only way to the Father is through the Son, and that's it. I mean, you know, I think if we love people, we tell them the truth.
So what hope do you have now, essentially, that you did not have when you were the kid lighting the menorah, getting the gifts that you always kind of envied by comparison, the Christian gifts of Christmas? What hope do you have now that you didn't have, beyond just a better holiday to celebrate?
Well, I can give you the pat answer that I have hope in a life that's eternal, but it's not a pat answer, because as a Jewish child, I was a very small child, I was afraid of death, because when my uncle died at a very young age and I went to the only two rabbis in town, their answer to me when I asked where my uncle was, they told me dead was dead. And so, you know, there's a hope now for life eternal and a gracious and merciful God, even for the people who don't believe that there's always an opportunity and a chance to the last minute, that God is so gracious and merciful that these people's, you know, their hearts like mine will be turned and they'll believe. And And I can't explain how that happens. Only by power of the Holy Spirit. Again, no one converted me. No one witnessed to me except through their life as a Christian. You know, and, you know, I guess you do see Christ in people. And the Holy Spirit sometimes works very slowly in your heart, even when you reject them. And I'm living proof of that. Certainly, even after conversion, I never thought I'd be a pastor in the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, let alone my son, who's now a pastor in the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. So, you know, it's pretty amazing. God's got a really good sense of humor.
Yeah, he does. Pastor Ed Balfour, thank you very much again for being our guest.
And, you know, you can call me during one of the Christian holidays and be fine, because I'm a Christian now, just in case you haven't figured that out by now.
I'll tell you what I'll do is...
You know, I don't want to sound like a Jewish mother, but you never call, Tom.
Yeah. I will instruct my producer not to exercise such deep-seated stereotypes. Thank you very much again.
Okay.
We'll
keep
call.
Keep making a living
we'll
here,
call,
boy.
We promise we'll call. Next
right.
week. We promise.
Yeah, next time will be Yom Kippur, I know. That's all right, no problem. I'll be fasting that day, don't call.
All right. Pastor Ed Balfour is a former Orthodox Jew and pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. We're going to be talking with Wesley Smith when we come back from this break. We got a minute or two here. Before we go to that break, let me take that opportunity to tell you a little bit about our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for December. We spent the last half hour talking with Ed Balfour about Hanukkah and about Christmas. Christians would do well to clear away some of the purely cultural aspects and purely traditional aspects of Christmas as well. One of those is the whole Santa Claus problem. Now, I'm not telling you that you can't play Santa Claus with the kids, but while you're doing that, you might also tell them the truth. Never hurts to tell your kids the truth. The truth about a 4th century bishop in what is today Turkey named Nicholas, who preached Christ and gave gifts. He's the subject of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for December, St. Nicholas, the Real Story of the Christmas Legend. You can get it for your kids or your grandkids as a Christmas gift. Call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. That's the number for Concordia Publishing House. You can also browse before you buy at Issues Etc.'s website. It's issuesetc.org. Now, the book costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Yesterday was the last day you could have ordered it and got it by Christmas without asking for express shipping. You will have to ask for express shipping if you want it by Christmas. You can also go into one of Concordia Publishing House's local stores. One is at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis, and the other is here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. When you go in, when you call, when you write, mention Issues, Etc. We'll be right back and talk with Wesley Smith.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.